Welcome to Mentoring Moments. Mentoring Moments is a sub-series of the E-Commerce Edge podcast. It is composed of clips taken from Jason's one-to-one and group mentorship sessions. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Mentoring Moments. I'm here with my friend, Kevin Zaw, and he's got some fantastic questions for me today. He's one of my new mentees for my latest intake of the Mentoring Moments mentorship program. Kevin, over to you. What are your questions for me today?
Yeah, so one of the questions I had was trying to understand the difference between a composable commerce solution versus headless commerce, and also understanding, you know, what the value of a composable commerce solution is for B2B. Because typically when I hear about companies wanting to do a B2B implementation, it's typically because they want to lower the cost to serve. When you think about implementing composable commerce solution, it's more expensive to maintain and implement. What is the ultimate value for a B2B company to utilize a composable commerce solution?
This is such a great question. It's such a relevant question. It's a question my clients come to me with on a pretty regular basis because they keep hearing these two terms. It's the buzz. There's a buzz around headless. There's a buzz around composable. And the challenge is that no one really has a really clear definition of either of those two things. So I'm gonna try to give you my definition based on my experience and based on what I'm seeing emerge in the market as some of the new quote unquote design patterns that I'm seeing emerge in the market. And when we talk about design patterns, you already know this, but for the benefit of the audience, when we think about design patterns, we're thinking about ways in which solutions are architected together, because very rarely is there a one-size-fits-all solution for everybody, meaning, okay, I'm going to put in one single piece of technology and it's going to meet all of my technology needs, both back-end and front-end. So we have these common design patterns where we have this common stack that gets architected together to meet a certain use case or a certain set of requirements. And if we think about an analog between in a comparison between the B2B world and the B2C world, there's a lot more common design patterns, particularly for commerce in the B2C world than there are in the B2B world. The B2B world is significantly more immature. The technologies, the underpinning technologies for B2B commerce are significantly more immature compared to the B2C world. And as a result of that, in the B2C world, we have this really common stack depending on what size the organization is that we're talking to. Now, of course, there are outliers and there are unique use cases, but generally speaking, if someone's a new startup and they're in the B2C world, they're going to be using something like a Shopify with a Klaviyo, with a couple of maybe five or six common apps for their front-end experience. And then in the back end, they're going to be using something like Xero, or they're going to be using something like QuickBooks. And then they're going to integrate those two together using something like A2X as an integration middleware tool. And they're off to the races up until they get to the sort of next level. And then maybe they'll need more of a proper inventory management solution, or maybe they'll need a WMS solution at some point. So there's these common stacks in the B2C world at different phases of growth. The B2B world, we don't have that. We've got something that is oftentimes extremely unique, meaning the organizations that we encounter in the B2B world, they're very different. And we even have differences whether you're a manufacturer, a wholesaler, a distributor. In each of those scenarios, we have different needs because obviously on the manufacturing side, we've got manufacturing workflows. In some cases, we've got light manufacturing. In some cases, we've got assemblies. Some cases, we've got heavy manufacturing with heavy workflows and multiple contract manufacturing partners, et cetera. So the B2B world is very unique. But your question as it relates to B2B is, when I start thinking about the B2B world, even the answers to your questions become a little bit different than they do in the B2C world. Now, generically speaking, when we talk about composable, in my opinion, the entire technology sector, the entire technology world has always been composable. I have never seen in my 20 plus years of doing this, I have never seen a single piece of technology that could meet a business's every technology need. So even if they used just one different system for the back end, let's say they use Microsoft D365, for example, in the back end. So they use Microsoft's ERP in the back end. They won't, 99% of the time, they won't be using a Microsoft product on the front end. Or the same even with SAP or Oracle or Salesforce. It's very common that especially in the enterprise space for B2B, someone will be using a different back-end system for their ERP versus a different front-end system for their e-commerce or their web front-end. Even if they're non-transactional, they'll be using maybe a CMS on the front-end that is not part and parcel of their core back-end stack. And as a result of that's where this term of composability comes from. We need to be able to pick best of breed components for our back office, for our front office, for our customer facing components. And even with within our customer facing stack, there may be, you may have a default CMS or a default e-commerce platform, but you may be using a third party search, merchandising and personalization platform. You may be using a CDP. You may be using a marketing automation platform. You may be using a loyalty platform. You may be using a CPQ platform. You may be using these different components that then are integrated together via APIs to allow the data to flow from one system to another as required. That's this term of composability. We are picking best of breed components as part of our back and front end stack to meet our business requirements. And that's often what I do when I come in with a B2B brand, is they don't know where to start. They're like, hey, maybe I get to them and they say, hey, the only component that you can't touch is our ERP. We've spent $500,000 or $1 million on this ERP system. That is staying. We're not ripping and replacing that out. You just worry about the front end. You worry about system integration. You worry about all the stuff that we need to add to be able to create a really good front end experience, but you ain't touching our ERP. Or sometimes I'll come in and they'll say, hey, look, there's no sacred cows here. You look at our entire business. We're getting ready to establish maybe a new digital channel, a new route to market. Maybe it's EDI, maybe it's Punchout, maybe it's e-commerce, whatever it is. You take a holistic look at our entire stack. You look at our data, and we're willing to look at everything very holistically and see what the best solution is for the back end, for the front end, et cetera. So it's basically all about meeting merchants where they are when we start thinking about composability. Does that kind of make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It really depends on, I think, what technology they value, what parts of their commerce platform they value, and trying to figure out if they want best of breed or if they want more of an extension of a platform they already have.
Yep. You've absolutely nailed it. Now, when we start thinking about headless in the context of composability, headless is oftentimes sold by agencies, by platform vendors, not necessarily because it is the best solution for a merchant, but because it is the best solution for the agency or the vendor. And what I mean by, pardon me, what I mean by that is that a headless implementation automatically means more lock-in to the vendor and to the agency that provides that solution. Because in a headless scenario, what we're doing is we are extrapolating out the front-end experience, and this is usually, that term is almost always used exclusively in the context of the front-end experience that the customer interacts with, the experience that the customer sees. Now, headless can be contrasted with the term monolithic. And what does monolithic mean? Monolithic means that the front-end experience is provided by a single vendor, meaning that the front-end UI, the user experience, and the back-end database, admin infrastructure, et cetera, is all joined and they're run out of one single platform. And those platforms are either run off the same server or a combination of servers where everything is hosted by the single vendor. Now, this starts to get a little bit more complex in that some of the front-end vendors, so your Shopify's of the world, your BigCommerce's of the world, whoever, the VTEX's, the Magento's, whoever it might be, this conversation around headless is becoming a little bit more complex because a lot of these vendors are moving to headless on their own platform, which means that typically headless meant that you had either a completely bespoke front end, maybe built in React, but it's built on a completely custom front end UI. And then that was integrated with a back end e-commerce platform for catalog management, for promotions management, for checkout, for all the core components of the back-end functions. And then that was integrated with a completely custom front-end user experience, user interface via APIs. So they would build a custom homepage. They would build a custom category page. They would build a custom PDP. They would build a custom cart page. They would maybe build a custom checkout with only the plumbing of the checkout plugged into that. Now, what's happened is over the last couple of years, brands have realized that going to this headless model, which means the front end is completely custom, the back end may be more of an out-of-the-box solution and integrated together via API, what they've realized is as the world has increasingly moved to a SaaS platform delivery model of software, a lot of brands have realized we took a step backwards when we went to headless, because now we've got this completely custom front end that we have to have custom developed, custom, like it's hosted, it's self-hosted. We're hosting it on maybe AWS infrastructure or Oracle infrastructure or Google Cloud infrastructure, wherever it is we're, or Netlify or wherever it is we're hosting that front end. But now that is custom built. It's been custom built maybe by an agency. Then that's been custom integrated with the back end via custom middleware tool. And now all of a sudden we're back to the bad old days where we've got to secure our own front end. We've got to build the scalability of our own front end. We've got all this complexity in our front end. Now we've maybe still got a simple back end in the sense that it's still SaaS, but now we've got all this new infrastructure and we've got all this custom stuff that's been built out and has to be maintained and extended over time. That's moving us maybe back to the bad old world where everything was self-hosted, front end, back end, databases, everything. So what's emerged is two different phenomena that have happened. One is FEAS, or front end as a service platforms, have started to emerge, which means, okay, maybe I've got a SaaS backend and my e-commerce provider backend provider is a SaaS platform and I consume it by APIs. And now I've got a front end as a service provider where they host the front end and my agency builds out on this front end framework and it's still hosted by the vendor. They worry about scalability. They worry about security. They worry about the API layer, et cetera. And then maybe we have only maybe bespoke middleware tool, or maybe we're using a iPaaS, an integration platform as a service as the middleware. And now we're back to that full front end and back end SaaS world, but they're still, it's still headless in the sense that I've got a separate front end as a service provider and a separate back end as a service provider. Now we have the final phenomenon, which is starting to emerge, which is we have front end being hosted by the same vendor as the back end, but they've gone headless on their own stack. So I'll use Shopify as an example. So they offer both a monolithic version of Shopify and they offer a headless version of Shopify where the front end and the back end are both hosted by Shopify. So they've got their standard monolithic system, which is the front end and the back end are joined natively together via their own back end systems. And the Liquid theme engine on the front end is their own theme engine, and Liquid is, so you can think of it like their proprietary version of JavaScript, and you can build storefronts directly in Liquid. They now have a new front-end and back-end architecture called Hydrogen and Oxygen, where they will host a completely separate standalone storefront, completely separate back-end, and the front-end and the back-end are joined together via purely by an API connection for every component. So everything in the storefront is completely API driven, as opposed to pulling data directly from the database in a traditional monolithic front end and back end joined at the hip model. And we're seeing other brands. BigCommerce has just announced their own headless front end that's hosted by them and joined together via APIs. We've got VTEX, which is, they've got a monolithic model, but it's headless on their own platform. So basically they've got their own front-end storefront technology, which is hosted by them in a SaaS model, but it's joined together to the back-end via APIs. It's not joined together on the same server, making a direct database connection. So this is the way the world is slowly moving. And the reason why that headless even became a thing was primarily around performance. So whenever you've got a monolithic deployment model of software from a front-end perspective, usually there's a performance penalty in that environment, because now instead of having that logic all have to run and we have to do all these back-end database calculations, we've got to do all this stuff in a monolithic way where we're joined directly at the hip to the back-end, we now have decoupled the front-end from the back-end and we now are doing things via APIs, which can be extremely fast, right? And so we've got this, instead of having a whole bunch of really complex logic needing to sit in the front end environment and this complex communication layer needing to be sitting between the back end and the front end in a monolithic way, in a monolithic, traditional monolithic deployment, we now have this decoupling. So we can build our front end in a very lightweight way, and we can query only for the exact data sets that we need. We're going to just query the database. And this is also where GraphQL and other technologies like GraphQL start to become very important or additionally important. Whereas in a monolithic environment, we have this preset. It starts to get quite technical, but I'll try to make sure that I'm keeping this as applicable to your question as possible. In a monolithic environment, we will have a standard data structure for a page type, for example. So we will have a situation where everything that could ever potentially or possibly be needed by a merchant on a category page, for example, in a monolithic environment, that will be default available to that page type in that storefront, that native out-of-the-box monolithic storefront. However, what happens when we want to create a really unique category page that functions in a really unique way? We may not need that entire, say, for example, XML data set that would normally be required to populate all the different pieces of information on a category page. We may not want to show review stars. We may not want to show ratings. We may not want to show all of the variants on a category page. We may not want to show a category's description. There's lots of things we may not want to do on a category page, but in a monolithic environment, they have to surface all of that information to that particular page type just in case the merchant wants to do all those things on the category page. So to minimize customization in a monolithic environment, they will make everything available to that page type. And then basically the developers will simply hide or obscure different pieces of information from that page type and effectively ignore certain data coming to that page type. In a headless world, we now, via these different query types, and because we now are not constrained by what the vendor says this page type should have, we can design our different page types, and we can design our customer journeys in a completely bespoke way. And then all we're doing is querying the backend system for the exact pieces of information we want to show at that exact moment to that exact customer in that exact scenario, right? So what we're doing is we're making these queries to the backend. We're pulling in specific product types. We're pulling in specific pieces of information around the customer. We're pulling in specific pieces of information around inventory, pricing, all these different things on the front end in a headless way. And in a headless way, we define what the customer should see. We define what the customer journey should look like. And we can be very granular in how we do that. And so what that means is that we can offload a lot of we can dramatically reduce the front-end logic that is required in that environment because we are being very selective about the data that we're pulling from the back-end and presenting in the front-end. Now, one additional challenge. So that typically what that means is it speeds up the front-end and it makes it much more lightweight. And it means that we get better Lighthouse scores with Google, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? And it also allows us to completely customize that front end journey in ways that make the brand unique and make the brand experience unique. Now, one of the other challenges in a headless environment is that now all of a sudden, any other apps or third-party systems that we would typically take for granted that could be plugged into the front end via, say, for example, an app ecosystem. Let's just use Shopify as an example. There's nearly 10,000 apps in the Shopify app store today. And in the standard monolithic deployment of Shopify, that standard combined front-end, back-end monolithic deployment with using their Liquid front-end theme engine, when you plug in an app that has been certified for Shopify, then it can leverage all of those standard out-of-the-box sections, for example, and other modular components of that monolithic front end. It can leverage all that when the app gets installed. It can create its own components in the theme and plug in different components into the theme to make those available to the front end immediately. So there's a standardized framework of how to do that when you build an app for a a platform that is monolithic in nature, because that monolithic front end defines how you interact with that front end. Now, all of a sudden, if you go to headless, now all of a sudden you can't just install those apps and they just work. They just work out of the box. Now you have to pick apps, usually, not in all instances, but generally speaking, you now have to pick apps that have an API layer available to them so that you can pull in, say, for example, let's say you wanted to use Klaviyo on the front end. And now instead of just installing the app and say, for example, the sign up bar is now available to Liquid, and it just all of the events that happen in Shopify so that you can trigger off things like transactional emails and stuff, it all just works seamlessly together because Klaviyo has built their app to work with the Liquid theme engine and has been built to integrate and understand all of the events that happen on the front end, the add to cart function within Liquid, the browse a category, browse a product page, abandon cart, all those different events that happen in that monolithic system. It's all built in a homogeneous way to where all the app vendors know how those front end components work and can build against that, right? And can be, and set up listeners to, say, for example, a webhook event that happens in the standard front end. And then when that event happens, they can trigger off different things. In a headless environment, you don't benefit from all that default plumbing that happens between the front end and the back end. And so therefore, now all of a sudden, I would have to integrate my custom front end functions with Klaviyo, for example. I would have to embed the sign up form, the subscription form in there. When somebody subscribes, then I would have to hit the Klaviyo API. I would have to create that subscriber in Klaviyo automatically via API. I would have to send Klaviyo. I would have to architect the custom front end to where when specific events happened on the front end, then we would send those events to Klaviyo using their, what they call their metrics API endpoint. And metric is just Klaviyo's fancy term for an event. We would then log those events against those specific profiles that exist within Klaviyo. So we would have to manually build out that integration in our custom front end versus being able to pick up all those default integrations with that monolithic deployment. Now, as this specifically relates to B2B, typically B2B does not have an issue with front end performance. So one of the biggest reasons why people will deploy a headless environment on the front end is to increase the performance of the front-end experience. And if your website is getting hit with, if you're a B2C or D2C website, and you're getting hit with hundreds of thousands of visitors a day, maybe hundreds or thousands of concurrent visitors and checkouts at any given point in time, then performance and every single component of performance should be optimized. Plus, in the B2C and D2C world, oftentimes they're trying to create very custom user experiences, right? That are very brand unique. In the B2B world, typically, A, we're not seeing the volumes of concurrent visitors. We're just not seeing the number of transactions go through our front end that a B2C or D2C environment would. Plus, in terms of the workflow and the customer journey on the front end in the B2B world, yes, sometimes we've got some complex CPQ requirements for some parts of our catalog, but oftentimes the user experience it doesn't need to be highly custom. Basically, it needs to be highly functional, but it doesn't need to be highly custom. So if we have a standard theme on the front end, a standard monolithic deployment, it's got a homepage, it's got a category page, it's got a product page, it's got a cart, it's got a checkout. We don't need to make this, the brand experience doesn't have to be wild and crazy. It doesn't have to be super unique and memorable, but it has to be highly functional. And so headless is first of all, as a percentage of total commerce deployments, headless is in the absolute minority, depending on the country. And the data is a little bit sketch about this because there's no one single source of the data for this, but estimates by the major vendors, when we go and we query the major vendors about number of deployments that are headless, it's sub 5%. For most vendors, it's like around the 2%, 1 to 2%. Of deployments are headless today is the rough industry estimate. So we're talking, it's a tiny fraction of all commerce deployments on the front end. Now, when we get to B, it's even less. I don't even know, I would hesitate to even put a percentage on it. I would say it's points of a percent. Now, I think this will change as more and more platforms go headless on their own platform to improve the performance of their front end, I think that then that is when we will see a mass adoption of headless, because that will become the default deployment model as opposed to a default monolithic deployment model of today. So in the B2B world, headless is not common. It's usually not needed because we usually don't have performance issues. We usually are not trying to create this wild and crazy, hyper memorable UI experience. We're a hyper branded UI experience. We're trying to create a highly functional UI experience. And so most B2B platforms of today for e-commerce that have really good default B2B functionality, we deploy them as monolithic. They surface all of their B2B functions through their native front-end Theme Engine. And that's how B2B is usually deployed today. Is that all? I know that was very long-winded. And it's hard to cover this stuff without covering a little bit of the history of how headless and composable came to be. But in my opinion, in a nutshell, our industry has always been composable because there has never been a one-size-fits-all platform. The composable crowd, or the mock crowd, as we like to call it, they like to think that this new term of composable means that systems that we're choosing to deploy in a composable way today are all API enabled. They're all ready to go for integration so that you can plug in best of breed components really easily with each other. But let's be honest, even for systems without APIs, as long as you can either have an ODBC connection or you can get a CSV out of them and a CSV back into them, realistically, the tech stack has always been composable. It's just as more and more components adopt an API-first mentality and modality, it is now easier to integrate these systems together. But from my way of thinking, tech stacks have always been composable because there's never been a one-size-fits-all solution that can work for everything. And from a headless perspective, the whole reason why headless even came about is because the B2C world wanted to create these hyper-bespoke front-end experiences, and it was difficult to do in a monolithic model. And so that's where the impetus and the performance gains that could come along with a headless deployment model, especially as Google started to emphasize speed and performance as part of their ranking algorithm, that is what pushed people into a headless model for the front end. Does that join the dots? Hey team, have a big favor to ask you. Please pause this episode and send the link of this episode to someone you know that you think would enjoy this content. Really appreciate you spreading the word. This is how we grow. We're not a Joe Rogan. We don't have big, massive advertising budgets, but we absolutely want to grow. We want to get the learnings from all of these episodes out to as wide of an audience as possible, and we need your help to do it. Thank you, and now back to your listening.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I didn't realize that part of the reason companies chose to go headless was to be able to improve in performance. And the example you gave with Google makes a lot of sense. I always thought the reason that companies want to move headless is because they want to configure their front-end experience, specifically for the D2C space, where they want to have more control over that, opposed to having limitations over what the vendor chooses their front-end to be. But that makes a lot of sense that the performance issue improves because they can choose what connections they want to make to their back-end. And if they have a lot of orders and they have a lot of visitors, then performance is going to be really key, and being able to control that's really important.
You've hit the nail on the head. So yeah, look, we could go down there's many rabbit holes we could go down here, but I think the issue I have with the mock crowd, M-A-C-H, and the issue that I have with the headless crowd and the composable crowd is that I think agencies have over positioned headless in scenarios where it's not needed and won't genuinely benefit the merchant in significant ways, because you can build a highly performant front end. If you write very clean theme code, you can write very hyper performant front ends on BigCommerce, Magento, VTEX, Magento maybe not so much because it's got some fundamental architectural flaws that make it really challenging to build performant front ends. But any modern SaaS e-commerce platform, if you know what you're doing and you write clean code, you can write hyper-performant front ends using their out-of-the-box theme engine. So Shopify, BigCommerce, VTEX, any of the major SaaS vendors, you can still write very performant front ends. But one of the reasons why agencies have been so quick to embrace headless is because it creates an insane amount of lock-in, right? Because effectively now we've got this completely bespoke, custom-built front end using the architecture and using the language of their choice on the front end. It's usually React, but it doesn't have to be. It could be any kind of front-end architecture that you want. And so when you go and you build this headless front end, it locks in the customer to the agency because it's not easy to just transfer that front end over to another agency and let them pick up and run with it. However, if you build it in the monolithic way and you use in the case of BigCommerce, it's Stencil. That's their native front end theme engine. It's called Stencil. Liquid is the native front end theme engine and language for Shopify. When an agency learns that native front end, even if you build it in quite a customized way, you use a lot of custom logic within their native theme framework, that becomes much, much easier. If someone has a falling out with their agency that developed that front end, it becomes very easy for another agency that understands that theme engine to come in, take that over, and run with it and enhance and extend and maintain that front end environment. If it's bespoke, it becomes much harder. So agencies and platform vendors have embraced the headless thing because it creates default stickiness with the provider, the vendor, and the agency. And so that's why they're pushing it under the, I like to use the performance thing as a bit of a red herring, not saying that headless can't be faster than a native SaaS front end, because it certainly can be, but it doesn't have to be. And it doesn't automatically mean that it's going to be more performant, because you can create a crappy front-end design, and you can create a crappy front-end architecture natively using a native theme engine or a completely bespoke front-end. They can both have crappy performance, or they can both have excellent performance. It's just how you ultimately build them that matters.
Gotcha. Do we have time for one or two more questions?
Absolutely. Fire away.
So one of the questions I had, I just want to be clear. So when you refer to agency, oftentimes I'll use the term SI partner in my world. Is that interchangeable terms?
Yes, they are. Yes. So you, yes and no. So SI stands for system integrator. And sometimes in the commerce world, we would use SI. It can be used interchangeably with agency, but sometimes system integrators are their own kind of agency. For example, you might have an integration partner. Sometimes that skill set will sit within the agency. So they'll do all your system integration, meaning they'll do the build of your e-commerce solution, and then they will do the backend integration, whether that's a bespoke integration using Python or Lambda or some of these other solutions out there, or they might be using an iPaaS, an integration platform as a service, your Soligos of the world, your Patchworks of the world, your different integration middleware platform providers, but they don't necessarily have to be one and the same. So not all agencies have system integration skill sets in-house, or they may work with a system integration platform like a Patchworks or a Jitterbit, and they will standardize on that platform, which kind of has native endpoint connectors for the different commerce systems and the different ERP and other backend systems. And then they just get skilled on that middleware platform and how to build out connectors on that middleware platform, as opposed to building system integration completely from scratch in-house with their own custom middleware. So they can be interchangeable, but they don't have to be, meaning an agency might just do the design and architecture of the front end. They go and they build that, and then they might work with a partner, or the client may already have system integration capability in-house with their IT team, or they may already be working with a system integration vendor or partner that already handles all their integration for them. And so they will do the integration and the connection between the ERP, for example, and the e-commerce front end. They will own that entire piece. So there's different configurations of how that might work. And sometimes the e-commerce platform itself will have a native out-of-the-box integration with the backend system. I see that quite commonly in the B2B world, where the B2B front end will have an out-of-the-box integration with maybe three or four different ERPs, because they know that they're commonly integrating with, I don't know, maybe they know as a front end, they're always integrating with NetSuite, Financial Force, and SAP, and Dynamics 365. Maybe they know that 85% of their deployments are integrating with one of those four ERPs, and they say, okay, we've got this out-of-the-box integration with those four ERPs so that you don't need any custom middleware to make that happen. We will own that middleware piece as the vendor. So there's a number of different ways in which SI, that term SI, can relate to a specific type of partner. So an agency can be an SI, but I don't think that all agencies by definition are SIs. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Continuing my question about agencies and partners. So how do you typically, from your experience, how do you typically find that partners are pricing out their integrations? And the reason I ask that question is because from my experience working at these large enterprise organizations with large product suites, a big value is that if your source of truth is in your ERP or your CRM, then this commerce solution is an extension of that. And the integrations between them should be much less costly, as well as decrease your cost serve because you're not focusing on integrating these solutions that are designed to work together. So, you know, how are charters typically pricing out the cost of integrations with solutions that are from different vendors?
Yeah, there's probably as many different pricing and implementation pricing models in the integration world as there are pricing models for front-end builds. It can vary wildly depending on whether the agency in question has experience with the back-end integration, if they're using an out-of-the-box integration middleware platform, an integration platform as a service that's maybe already got a connection, a cartridge or a connector or an endpoint solution for the 2, 3, 4 systems that need to be system integrated. Also depends on whether there needs to be significant data transformation in the middleware. So if there needs to be significant data manipulation between the data that's coming out of the ERP and going to an endpoint solution and vice versa, then sometimes that integration middleware can get really complex, because now instead of just being pipes that plumb one piece of data on a one-to-one basis to another system, sometimes we need to bring data from 2 or 3 systems. We need to concatenate it. Maybe we need to truncate it. Maybe we need to mix data together in unique ways, or take one piece of data from one endpoint and then combine it with another, and then maybe do a calculation of data as it flows through middleware. So there's no, I guess, one size fits all or one. I can't give you an easy answer on that. And it does a little bit depend on whether there's out-of-the-box integrations that provided by some front-end vendors. It ranges, but I can tell you that integration is oftentimes a significant, especially today, in today's world, it's very rare that you would have a situation where integration is not a very significant portion of project cost. Very rarely. It's extremely rare. Maybe they've already got an integration middleware platform and all they're doing is unplugging one existing front-end system and plugging in a new front-end system and all the other integrations will stay the same, in which case that could be a very light lift integration effort. But oftentimes, it's not the case. They are going with a completely new stack. They're going with a whole bunch of integrations that need to come from, maybe they have an integration that comes from a WMS or from a 3PL provider. They've got integrations that are coming from maybe a CPQ engine. They've got integrations that are coming from maybe a PIM system that's got all the enriched product data and information that needs to flow, where you've got a data flow, where core data will flow from the ERP to the PIM, get enriched in the PIM, and then the PIM will need to be integrated with multiple front-end systems, EDI, punch-out, e-commerce. So there's almost as many integration design patterns as there are front-end design patterns, I guess is what I'm saying. And it's very situational. But in general, integration tends to be very complex and very costly. You just can't get around it these days. There's no such thing, even with a quote-unquote integration middleware platform that has an out-of-the-box cartridge for all of the endpoints in the stack. Usually they will need to be customized because of the way that each endpoint is configured is so unique. And the way that those data sets look in an ERP, for example, they sometimes can be so unique that the integration is just not straightforward. Even if you have a standard out-of-the-box connector, usually there needs to be some form of customization there to meet the business needs.
Gotcha. And my last question is around platforms that, like, customers are looking at their source of data for to choose their commerce platforms. From my experience, if a customer had their social truth be a CRM, then oftentimes they would see the B2B commerce as being an extension of that. If their social data was ERP, B2B commerce would be an extension of that. Is there any other platform that customers would look at as being a source of data that they would look for the B2B commerce platform to be another extension of?
PIM systems are probably the single biggest other component in the stack that would be the single source of truth for all of the customer-facing product. Not all, but certain. So typically in the B2B world, even if someone has a PIM or is looking at implementing a PIM, because price, for example, is an attribute of the customer, not an attribute of the product. Unlike in the B2C, D2C world, where price is an attribute of the product, not the customer. So in the B2B world, even if someone has a PIM, the non-price and non-inventory product, enriched product data would be living in the PIM. So all the images, all the videos, all the product descriptions, all the detailed product attributes and attribute arrays, all of the product associations, upsells, cross-sells, substitute products, all that information would typically live in the PIM system, product information management system. And then all of the core data, the name, the SKU, the inventory, and the price would typically all still come from the ERP. So those are the three primary systems that we see as being single source of truth systems is ERP, CRM, and PIM systems. Those are the three primary back-end systems that are integral to e-commerce and creating a really good, seamless B2B front-end experience and will influence the type of system and which vendor you choose for the front-end experience.
If you'd like to get mentored by Jason for free, head over to greenwoodconsulting.net, scroll to the bottom of the page, and click Get Mentored by Jason.